years have passed since the Saudi-led coalition waged a full-scale war against Yemen, and it continues right now for almost 9 years. Millions of people have been displaced. Millions of people are in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. How do you evaluate the international community's response and reaction to this crisis?
Yes, unfortunately, in my view, the international community failed to respond to this catastrophe. The human rights structures, they call it the world's worst humanitarian crisis. You know, this is the very good expression to define what is going on there in Yemen. By the time being, more than 300,000 of innocent people have lost their life in Yemen. That's a huge number, you know. More than millions of people have been displaced and disappeared. Only in January, more than 900 air strikes have been conducted against the infrastructures and innocent people of Yemen. More than 900 air strikes only in 1 month, you know. And more than 24 million of Yemeni people, unfortunately, are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. More than 10 million of Yemenis are in a very serious situation of starving, you know. So that's the responsibility of the international community to show its determination to help the Yemeni people. But unfortunately, there is no responsibility, there is no accountability on this issue. The people are dying there, specifically the women, the children, and the elderly people. But what we hear is only some slogans to protect human rights. So if you want to protect human rights, you should go there to Yemen and to protect the rights of the people, not to protect the aggressor, unfortunately. And nowadays, this issue should be discussed in the context of the Human Rights Council. But unfortunately, due to some political decisions, the naming and shaming of this coalition has been removed from the reports of the High Commissioner and the Secretary General of the United Nations due to some political intentions by some specific countries in the context of the human rights mechanism. And I believe this is not fair against the innocent people of Yemen. And the naming and shaming, again, should be back to the reports of the Secretary General and the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and there should be resolutions there. So the situation there is worsening, unfortunately, but the policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran is first to provide humanitarian assistance to the people and also simultaneously to stop the attacks against the innocent people there in Yemen and to start immediately the Yemenis Yemeni talks, actually. So that's their issue, and they should settle it. But what is the responsibility of the international community is to stop the aggression, to stop the attacks against the people, and to deliver the humanitarian assistance there. So Yemen now, in my view, is the most important exhibition of violation of human rights in different fields. So you see some other cases now in the international community that what is the approach of those countries that are pretending that they are protecting the rights or the rights of the people. So, but what is their approach towards the Yemeni people? So you see, we have some other cases now so that they have opened their own fronts, their own borders to the people, that we are not against that because the rights of the people should not be violated everywhere. But by the way, there shouldn't be any contradictory approach or double standard approach. So we believe that they should play an important role in this regard to be accountable.
And what do you think this heavy silence on the part of the international community towards the issue of Yemen is triggered by?
You know, that this is not the first issue that they have kept silence, unfortunately. Human rights for these countries, as I have said in my introductory statement, is only a political tool to achieve foreign policy goals. So human rights for them is not in the context of the dignity of the people and to save the life of the people. they are concerned about the lives of the people in the countries that they have their own interest in, the, in those countries, not in the countries that they do not see any interest for them, unfortunately. So because of this, the best way absolutely is to depoliticize the human rights. And if we depoliticize the human rights, so we can focus on the rights of the people to see that what kinds of human rights are violated, in which countries, and we can mobilize our capacities to normalize the situation. But while they are politicizing the issue, so I do not see any perspective in this regard.
Well, let's be specific. We all know that what is happening in Yemen and those weapons that are killing the Yemeni people and Yemeni children and women are weapons produced by the United States. Everyone knows that, and it's nothing to hide and stay silent about it. So do you think that there is a tool that could be used by the human rights entities, global human rights entities, to criticize at least the United States on the global stage and use that tool to bring an end to that selling of arms to Saudi Arabia and then dropping those arms on the heads of the people in Yemen?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's not alone the United States that is transferring weapons to the coalition there to kill the innocent people in Yemen. There are several other European countries that are unfortunately transferring and selling their own weapons to the coalition. And there has been a debate on that in several international forums. And in my view, there should be a campaign at the international level, you know. Why they are keeping silence? Because the people that are being killed there are Muslims. Are Muslims, you see that in each country that the Muslims are under aggression, so the Western European countries are keeping silence, unfortunately. This is the first. And the second, what is the root cause of catastrophe in Yemen? First, it started due to some political differences and the, between the some groups at the domestic level and the former government. So we should give the right for destiny, to their own people, actually, not to interfere in the domestic affairs of the countries. If the people of Yemen decided to have a different political structure, we should pay respect to that. That's their own right. That's a self-determination in accordance with international law. But because this self-determination is against the interest of some specific countries in the region, and Western European countries, they are against that. And you are abusing all the capacities in the media. They try actually to use and to abuse the media to deliver diversionary messages to the public and to the public opinion. And that's not true. That's not fair. I believe that the role of the media is very important in this regard, specifically in the Western European countries. What should be important for them? To achieve their own foreign policy goals or to save the life of the people that are dying there due to these aggressive operations and also these operations that are supported by the by those that they are claiming that are at the forefront of the human rights. In my view, a campaign should be started at the international level, not only against delivery or transferring of weapons to Yemen, but also against the aggressors and also against the prohibition and making obstacle on the way of transferring humanitarian assistance. The people in Yemen now are in dire need of humanitarian assistance, unfortunately. This is the first priority there in Yemen. And they have been deprived, unfortunately. And that's a pity that the international community and the international public opinion do not hear their voices, unfortunately. That's the role of the media, in my view, to deliver the message of the Yemeni people to the international community and to put pressure on the countries at the political side.
All right, let's move on to Palestine. The international community seems to be apathetic toward the struggle in Palestine and the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories, which has been ongoing for more than seven decades. And whatever measures have so far been taken by the international community was just the expression of concern in words and no action. We do know that the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights has described the situation in Palestine as deplorable. But it's just a matter of verbal reaction to the issue, and no action has so far been taken to bring the Palestinian struggle to an end. What initiatives can Muslim countries and the Islamic Cooperation Organization take in this regard?
The Muslim countries should see the Palestine as a cause for their own unity. And in my view, that's very important. Because now, unfortunately, Islamic countries, they have been separated, and there are several differences amongst the Islamic countries that it shouldn't be like this, unfortunately. But Palestine, in my view, has the capacity to unite the Islamic countries. And you see that, unfortunately, some provocations and some moves that some Islamic countries have normalized their own relation with the Israeli Zionist regime. And this is against the interests of the innocent Palestinian people. So in my view, first, the Islamic countries should understand that they should help the innocent people in Palestine. So they are under aggression for several decades. Even sometimes you receive and you will see some declaration, some announcement by some European countries against the Israeli regime sometimes. I do not want to prejudge that whether they are sincere in their condemnation or not, but that's the fact that there are some statements or announcements. The expectations are high from the Islamic countries. So they have been divided on Palestine, unfortunately, and it shouldn't be like this. So this is the first issue. The issue is not as easy that we perceive among the Islamic countries. The second issue is that even in the context of the international human rights structures, the issue of Palestine and Israel is discussed under two items in the agenda of the Human Rights Council. One under item 7, so the reports are being discussed regarding the situation of human rights in the occupied Palestinian territories. And the second is a commission on inquiry that has been approved more than 1 year ago. And again, on the issue of human rights in the occupied Palestinian territories. There is a huge pressure, not only by the Israeli Zionist regime, but also by its allies and supporters in the Western European countries, to remove Israel from the agenda that are discussed in the context of the Human Rights Council. I made it very clear in the high-level segment of the Human Rights Council that Item 7 should remain, and the Commission on Inquiry should continue its activities and should be also funded with necessary contributions and budget. So they are going to abuse these mechanisms, you know, to put pressure on the countries not to vote in favor of continuation of these commission activities and also keeping or preserving the item 7 in the agenda. So this is again the second issue. But by the way, again, in my view, what is important is that Israel should be at the top agenda of international human rights mechanisms, specifically Human Rights Council, and the Islamic countries should not allow the Western European countries and the United States to remove these two important issues or items from the agenda of the Human Rights Council. Unfortunately, in this issue, the Islamic countries are united. And this is very important. So having this experience, I believe that the Islamic countries should always bring this issue of aggression and the crimes of the Israelis against innocent Palestinian people to the top agenda of other international organizations, specifically the United Nations system. So only through political pressure and only through the unity of Islamic countries we may achieve something.
Thank you very much, Kazem Gharibabadi, the Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights. Thank you very much. This is the end of this edition of Face to Face. I'm Yusuf Jalali.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
NASA insists American astronaut Mark VanderHei's homecoming at the end of the month remains unchanged, even as recent tensions and developments in Ukraine has resulted in cancelled launches, broken contracts, and an escalating war of words between the leaders of the United States and Russian space agencies. We've prepared for you an article written by staff writers of the Associated Press news agency in Cape Canaveral, Florida, under the heading, U.S. Astronauts' Return Hangs in the Balance as Tensions with Russia Escalate. The U.S. astronaut Mark VanderHei has made it through nearly a year in space, but now faces what could be his trickiest assignment, riding a Russian capsule back to Earth in the midst of deepening tension between the two countries. NASA insists VanderHei's homecoming at the end of the month remains unchanged, even as recent developments and tensions in Ukraine has resulted in cancelled launches, broken contracts, and an escalating war of words between the leaders of the U.S. and Russian space agencies. Many worry space officials of both countries are putting decades of peaceful partnership at risk, most notably at the International Space Station, the ISS. Mark VanderHei, who on Tuesday, 15th of March, broke the U.S. single spaceflight record of 340 days, is due to leave with two Russians aboard a Soyuz capsule for touchdown in Kazakhstan on 30th of March. He will have logged 355 days in space. The world record of 438 days belongs to Russia. The retired NASA astronaut Scott Kelly, America's record holder until Tuesday, 15th of March, is among those sparring with the leader of the Russian space agency, Dmitry Rogozin, a longtime ally of Vladimir Putin. Scott Kelly has returned a medal to the Russian embassy in Washington, but believes the two sides can hold it together in space. Scott Kelly said, "We need an example set that the two countries that historically have not been on the most friendly of terms can still work somewhere peacefully. And that somewhere is the International Space Station. That's why we need to fight to keep it." NASA wants to keep the space station running until 2030, as do the European, Japanese and Canadian space agencies. The Russians have not committed beyond the original end date of 2024 or so. The US and Russia are the prime operators of the orbiting outpost, permanently occupied for 21 years, until SpaceX started launching astronauts in 2020. Americans hitch rides on Russian Soyuz capsules for tens of millions of dollars a seat. The US and Russian space agencies are still working on a system in which a Russian would launch on a SpaceX capsule beginning this fall, and an American would fly on the Soyuz, helping ensure a US and Russian station presence at all times. Mark Vanderhey, a 55-year-old and a retired Army colonel, moved into the International Space Station last April, launching on a Soyuz from Kazakhstan with Pyotr Dubrov and another Russian. He and Dubrov stayed twice as long as usual to accommodate a Russian film crew in October. As the situation 260 miles below intensified last month, Vanderhey acknowledged he was avoiding conversations about Ukraine with Dubrov and Anton Shkaplerov, their Russian commander. Three more Russians will blast off from Kazakhstan on Friday, 18th of March. Mark Vanderhey told an interviewer, "We haven't talked about that too much. I'm not sure we really want to go there." The NASA human spaceflight chief, Kathy Luders, who noted it would be very difficult to go it alone, said, "It would be a sad day for international operations if we can't continue to peacefully operate in space." SpaceX is taking three businessmen and an ex-astronaut escort to the space station at the end of March. In mid-April, SpaceX will deliver four astronauts for NASA before bringing back four on board since November. NASA and SpaceX refused to speculate on whether a seat could be made available for Mark Vanderhey. They say a NASA plane and small team will be in Kazakhstan as usual to move him back to Houston, Texas. A former NASA astronaut, Heidemarie Stefanchin Piper, whose father was born in Ukraine, said it was a difficult situation. She said, "We're sanctioning Russia, companies are pulling out of doing business in Russia, but then yet you still have the US government, the space agency, doing business with the Russians." Heidemarie Stefanchin Piper added, "You can't push a button and separate the two sides of the space station." Besides threatening to pull out of the space station and drop it on the US, Europe or elsewhere, Dmitry Rogozin had flags of other countries covered on a Soyuz rocket awaiting liftoff earlier this month. The launch was called off after a customer, London-based OneWeb, refused his demands that the satellites not be used for military purposes and the British government halt financial backing. The European Space Agency's reading, after missing a 2020 launch deadline for its Mars rover, a European-Russian effort, the project was on track for a September liftoff from Kazakhstan. Now it's most likely off until 2024, the next opportunity for Earth and Mars to be properly aligned. Russia has pulled stuff out of the French-run launch site in South America, suspending Soyuz launches of European satellites. All this comes on top of a Russian anti-satellite missile test in November that put the space station's four Americans, two Russians and one German on alert for days. Jeffrey Manber, now with the private Voyage Space Company, helped forge US and Russian ties in the mid-1990s. He sees the space station as one of the final holdouts of collaboration. But, he added, there is no going back if the partnership is ended and the result is a premature ending of the International Space Station program. John Logsdon, Professor Emeritus at George Washington University, expects the end of large-scale space cooperation between Russia and the West. He said, "Russia has been moving towards China already, and the current situation will probably accelerate that move.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Sunday, Saudi Arabia executed 81 men over terrorism-related charges. It's the largest mass execution the country has so far carried out on record. The figure exceeded the country's total death sentences it handed down last year. Of the 81 people, 73 were Saudi citizens, 7 were Yemeni, and 1 was a Syrian national. More than half of those executed were Shia Muslims, including teenagers from the Resif Qatif region. The convicts also included members of Yemen's Ansarullah movement. They were accused of having links to Daesh and Al-Qaeda terror groups, but documents verifying the charges are yet to be made public.
Look, in the past, it's been quite clear over a number of years that the kingdom is in no way averse to executing people without what under Sharia would count as due process, and in particular targeting individuals because of the beliefs they hold.
The announcement drew widespread condemnation from around the world. Rights activists say the prisoners were put to death for nonviolent acts. Advocates are also questioning the validity of the court proceedings and treatment of the inmates. They say some of the trials were held in secret and that the prisoners had been tortured. Saudi Arabia's last mass execution came on January 2, 2016, when the kingdom killed 47 prisoners, including prominent Shia cleric Sheikh Nimr Baghir al-Nimr. They, too, were given capital punishment without fair trials. The cleric's only crime was to call for democracy and rally anti-regime protests. The mass execution drew fierce criticism from the international community. Iran has called it an inhumane act that violated basic human rights principles and international law. The Iranian president has slammed Western countries' double standards as well as the silence and inaction of the self-proclaimed human rights advocates regarding the execution of innocent people. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has also slammed the Saudi execution of inmates as a heinous crime. It accused Riyadh of practicing the ugliest forms of sectarian discrimination. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet condemned the violent act. She said war crimes may have been committed if people were beheaded following court cases that do not offer proper fair trial guarantees. Some experts believe the move to be a muscle flex by Saudi Arabia amid the Russia-Ukraine conflict that is leading to a global energy crisis and has sent the West scrambling to fight alternative sources of oil. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's planned visit to the kingdom can indicate that the West will be forgiving of the country's crimes. As a matter of fact, human rights campaigners are accusing Johnson of trying to trade oil for blood. The same criticisms were leveled against the kingdom after the killing of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the country's consulate in the Turkish city of Istanbul. But no punishment came Saudi Arabia's way.
Well, clearly the kingdom is considered by the United States to be a very special ally. And in that regard, the priorities the Americans have in dealing with the kingdom relate to basically the massive oil reserves, which are still at Saudi Arabia's disposal. But there can be no doubt that the West and the news media generally, even though there's been some coverage of this story, is dealing with it in a very hypocritical manner.
Reports of mistreatment of prisoners in Saudi jails also abound. Without seeing proper consequences, the kingdom isn't likely to change course in the foreseeable future.
In the early hours of Sunday, massive explosions rocked the capital of Iraq's northern Kurdistan region, Erbil. A dozen ballistic missiles hit secret Mossad bases there, reportedly leaving several Israeli operatives dead. Then a statement came from Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. The force said it had fired powerful and precision strike missiles targeting a strategic center for conspiracy and evil acts of the Zionists. The IRGC said the attack follows Israel's recent crimes and promised that those atrocities would not go unanswered. The IRGC warned that further Israeli acts of aggression would receive a tough, decisive, and destructive response. It underlined that the security of Iranian nationals was the red line of the country's armed forces. Israel has long been blamed for a wide range of anti-Iran measures, including acts of sabotage against its nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iranian scientists. Former Israeli officials have also confirmed the regime's role in the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq in 2020. And just last week, two IRGC officers were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Syrian capital, Damascus. At the time, the IRGC vowed that Israel would pay for the crime. In 2018, Israel killed a number of Iranians during an attack on an airbase near the city of Homs in western Syria. There have been a number of Iranian military advisors in Syria, as requested by the Damascus government. Iran later retaliated with a barrage of missiles targeting Israeli military positions in the occupied Golan Heights. The missile strike on Erbil could be seen in the same light. Iraq's Kurdistan regional government officials have denied the presence of Israeli bases in Erbil, but the two sides enjoy friendly ties. Back in 2014, Israel bought Kurdish oil despite opposition from the central Iraqi government and threats to take legal action. 3 years later, Israel endorsed an independence referendum carried out in the Kurdistan region. And last year, Erbil hosted a conference on normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel, prompting public outcry. The Kurdish regional government said it was not aware of the conference being organized. The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for the Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country. The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country.
Iran's retaliatory strike against an informal Israeli base in Iraq, which was in response to an act of Israeli aggression in Syria, which resulted in the deaths of two members of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, serves as another stark reminder to Israel's ruling elite, namely that Iran has the intent and the capability to effectively respond to acts of Israeli aggression, either against Iran directly, or against Iranian interests in the Middle East, or against Iran's allies in the Middle East, such as Syria. And I am of the opinion that the Iranian retaliatory strike against the unofficial Israeli base in Iraq will not be lost on the Israeli ruling elite.
Syria and the Israeli regime are technically at war due to the latter's 1967 occupation of the Arab country's Golan Heights. The Israeli regime maintains a significant military presence in the territory, which it uses as a launchpad for its attacks on the Syrian soil. Israel has attacked Syria repeatedly through the past years. The reasons it provides fall short of being enough to justify the death and destruction that it has caused. Tel Aviv has been a key supporter of terrorist groups fighting to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad since March 2011. The regime has also been providing safe passage and medical treatment to the Takfiri terrorists who flee the Allies' defensive operations. Israel's recent attack on the Syrian capital led to the martyrdom of two Iranian military advisors with the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The elite military force has been providing Syria with military advisory assistance in the face of foreign-sponsored militancy.
Iran has developed a very strong and a very robust armed forces which can meet Israeli aggression. Nonetheless, the Israelis, because of the unconditional support they receive year on year from Washington, will continue to act in the most criminal way possible.
Israel violates international law as well as international humanitarian law and refuses to implement dozens of resolutions or abide by recommendations put forward by relevant United Nations committees. Isn't it time the UN or other world countries gave this the attention that it deserves before the situation spirals out of control? The UN Security Council meeting turned into a heated argument between Moscow and Washington. The US and Russian delegates exchanged accusations over alleged biological weapons in Ukraine. The Russian envoy warned the European countries of the danger posed by Ukraine's research into biological weapons. Russia says the US-funded biolabs have researched spreading the highly infectious bird flu virus through migratory birds and pathogens such as bacteria and viruses that can be transmitted from bats to humans. The US, however, rejected Russia's allegation of biological activities, claiming that biological laboratories in Ukraine have nothing to do with chemical arms. It also interpreted the accusation as a sign that Moscow plans to use chemical or biological weapons in Ukraine. Washington initially condemned Russia for spreading disinformation. Nevertheless, after Russia published documents showing that Kyiv was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon, U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland admitted the existence of U.S.-funded biological research facilities in the country, saying Washington is working with Kyiv to prevent Russia from getting the research materials. The contradictory remarks further deepen the world's doubts about the U.S. Why is the U.S. hastily attempting to destroy the materials? Is it trying to hide something?
Well, first of all, the United States specializes in moving its chemical and biological weapons activities away from its own territory to allow itself a degree of deniability. In other words, we didn't do that. It was a private venture of an academic institute or of a government department not related to the militaries.
The United States has spent more than $200 million on the work of biological laboratories in Ukraine. It has 30 biological laboratories and other related facilities in the country which are possibly involved in the production of bioweapons. And these are less than 10% of the 336 biological laboratories the U.S. reportedly controls in 30 countries around the world. Deputy Chairman of the Council of Ministers of Crimea, Georgi Muradov, says the United States had plans to open a biolab on the peninsula before its annexation to Russia. He also accused the Pentagon of developing biological weapons in its secret laboratories on the Ukrainian territory. Also, China has called on the United States to release all-around details of its biological laboratories in Ukraine and urged relevant parties to ensure their safety. The U.S. has blocked the building of the Biological Weapons Convention Verification Protocol for 2 decades and refused to accept inspections of biological facilities within and outside its borders, despite having over 300 biological laboratories all over the world. It seems that by doing so, the U.S. wants to protect the secrets of its biological labs worldwide. It's reasonable and legitimate for the international community to question the U.S. for that, especially since it has a history of using chemical weapons. The U.S. dropped massive quantities of white phosphorus on the Iraqi city of Fallujah during an attack on the city in November 2004, killing insurgents and civilians with the appalling burns that are the signature of this weapon. Also, 5 decades after the Vietnam War ended, Agent Orange continues to impact communities in Vietnam and Laos today. It contained dioxin, one of the most toxic chemicals known to humans. It is linked to increased rates of cancers and birth defects. Vietnam says several million people have been affected by Agent Orange, including 150,000 children born with severe birth defects.
Well, the United States has always managed to present two faces to the world. One is the face of the American democracy attempting to achieve peace, according to their propaganda, and the other is the military-industrial complex that runs the American economy by making wars. So the political element of the U.S. system denies involvement in such activities, while behind the back of the public, even the American public, is deceived in order to keep the regime popular at home. But behind the back of the American public, the United States is more involved than any other country in the world in these areas.
Biological weapons are seen as weapons of mass destruction together with nuclear and chemical weapons. Any suspicion of biological weapons must be promptly investigated. Therefore, the U.S. owes the world an answer on what it has been up to in its so-called biological research facilities in Ukraine.
September 11, 2001. The United States is hit by 4 coordinated terrorist attacks, the first major assault on the U.S. soil since World War II. Nearly 3,000 people are killed and some 20,000 others injured. The U.S. responds with an all-out war on Afghanistan, where the terror group Al-Qaeda that planned and carried out the attack was said to be based. Fast forward 20 years. U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order in September giving the Justice Department a 6-month notice to release the documents on the FBI's investigations into the incident. Yet on Thursday, the department acknowledged that it would miss the deadline, suggesting that they would be released by mid-April. It says the delay is due to continuing coordination with a number of foreign governments and ongoing interagency review. One of the governments in question is likely to be Saudi Arabia. Out of 19 terrorists involved in the attacks, 15 were Saudi nationals. The close ties between Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Saudi royal family also raised questions that Saudi Arabian authorities supported the operation. Some observers believe the conflict in Ukraine and the West's sweeping sanctions on Russia, especially its energy sector, which has sent fuel prices skyrocketing around the world, could explain the delay in the release of the documents, as the United States needs Saudi Arabia, with the world's second largest oil reserves, to fill in the gap.
And obviously there's a quid pro quo going on here. How serious it's going to be is another question. You still got hanging over all of this the fact that Vice President Cheney at the time, in 9/11, arranged for all these Saudis to leave the country, leave the United States and go back to Saudi Arabia. So there was no follow-up at the time, contemporaneously, with the Saudi presence in the United States, or the fact that most of the people who were involved in the actual hijackings of these planes were Saudis. So clearly, there is something here that is extremely troubling. And clearly, the Saudis do not want this out. And I suspect there are large sections of the United States government who are not interested in having a serious discussion about this.
But the delay isn't good news to thousands of families who are seeking justice for the loved ones they lost on 9/11. Soon after taking office, Joe Biden said the U.S. was ending all its support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, proclaiming that the war has to end. But, back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden, with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he staked much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States.
It's unlikely that people are going to support the United States in the hour of need without some concessions. I mean, I just don't see it. It's possible, I suppose. Maybe there's some threats or whatever, but it's unlikely. And the Saudis have been very clear in the paper today. They said they want more support by the United States for their adventure in Yemen, among other things. There was a list.
The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. But will it forgive possible perpetrators of attacks on its own citizens too? What message would that have for the attackers? Wouldn't that embolden them to commit even worse crimes, knowing that they can get away with murder in its most literal sense?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. Well, I will raise a few points about Ba'ath briefly, and then I will make a point about the current issues of the day. One thing about Ba'atha is that it achieved something that seemed impossible. What was it? It was that Ba'atha turned the people of the Arabian Peninsula of the pre-Islamic period, later on I'll explain how they were like before Ba'atha, into a virtuous people like the Islamic Ummah, of the Holy Prophet's rule. Such a thing seems impossible with the ordinary and conventional viewpoint. The people of Arabia in the period of ignorance before the Holy Prophet's Ba'atha had characterized some of which are mentioned in Nahjul Balagha and in history. They were misguided people, wandering aimless and extremely ignorant. They were suffering from great seditions caused by the extreme rage and ignorance. At the same time, as well as all these attributes that I enumerated, they were suffering from illiteracy and lack of understanding. They were devoid of any morality, and they did not have any goal and purpose. Nonetheless, they were extremely ignorant and extremely violent, unreasonable and stubborn. These were the characteristics of the people of Arabia, the people of Mecca, and the rest of the places that were there at that time, And these qualities were shared by their elders and younger ones, and their chiefs and subordinates.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, however, turned the same people into a united people, and he did so in a short period of time. If we look at the Muslims of the Holy Prophet's time, whether when they were confined to Medina or when they advanced to Mecca, Taif, and other places, we see that they were united, virtuous, and altruistic, and they enjoyed all their lofty temperaments. He turned the same people into such individuals that seemed impossible. No analysis would have found it possible to turn those people into such individuals in a short space of time. And later on, in less than 20 years, they received global recognition. The same people with those characteristics achieved worldwide fame in less than 20 years once they accepted Islam.
Allah, I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As the cost of living in the EU goes through the roof, union members held a demonstration outside a meeting of EU finance ministers in Brussels on Tuesday. They want the bloc's leaders to provide more support for EU citizens who are being hit hard by the financial ramifications resulting from the conflict in Ukraine.
And it's also why we need to say that we need to stop this war because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation, and now we have to say stop. Stop this war and stop Putin in Ukraine.
Finance ministers have signed off on the fourth package of sanctions against Russia. 600 individuals have been targeted and Russian exports too. However, there is a very negative boomerang effect for the EU itself.
We'll see overall higher inflation, pressure on energy and food prices, and market volatility. Rising energy and commodity prices, disruptions of supply chains, it all will have negative knock-off effect on consumer prices and on investment.
Russia, which is now the most sanctioned country in the world, has been removed from the so-called Most Favoured Nation clause relating to the World Trade Organization.
This major decision entitles the EU to increase customs duties at any moment on Russian products. As regards sanctions, all options remain on the table.
Finance ministers say 200 billion euro worth of loans are available to EU nations most impacted by the Ukrainian refugee crisis. Critics say if Western leaders had have shown more skill and compromise when listening to Russia's security concerns, the misery now being piled on Ukrainian citizens and the financial hardship being placed on EU citizens could have been avoided. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As the Ukraine exodus intensifies, Poland's major cities are starting to show signs of strain under the pressure, with local authorities warning that they simply can't cope with more arrivals.
This is just one of the many border crossings between Poland and Ukraine. Just behind me, a few meters, is Ukraine. Now, all day long, we've been witnessing coaches, vans, cars going backwards and forwards, supplies and aid going in, people and refugees coming out.
Whilst here, we managed to speak with Max, a Ukrainian from the Czech Republic. He's been waiting hours for his mother-in-law, who has fled from Kyiv. Speaking to Press TV, he informed us about his anger at the lack of help he sees on the ground from the rest of Europe.
I have no words how to describe overall situation. It's horrible. When people just crossing by in winter with kids, I have no words how to describe this situation. Frankly, there is support from Europe, but perhaps not quite enough.
Then suddenly, a call came through. Alex's mother-in-law had finally arrived.
I'm glad that we have finally succeeded.
Reunited again, finally. They now can head off to safety. But many more refugees aren't so lucky and remain stranded without key essentials. With reports of at least two Ukrainians crossing the Polish border every 3 seconds, how long can Poland maintain this huge humanitarian effort? Robert Carter, Dorohusk.
Iran expects a good agreement to be reached in the near future in its talks on the revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. This was made by Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian at a press conference following talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Moscow. Amir Abdollahian said the delay in the negotiations could lead to the creation of good ground for resolving the remaining issues. He also said that Russia has not created any obstacles in the negotiations on the JCPOA revival, and that the Vienna talks are in no way connected with the conflict in Ukraine.
Russia does not create any obstacles to reaching agreements. There is no connection between the developments in Ukraine and the Vienna talks. And until the end of the negotiations and the achievement of a good, powerful and lasting agreement, Russia will be close to Iran and will support Iran to achieve this agreement.
Meanwhile, Sergei Lavrov said his country has received written guarantees from the United States that Western sanctions on Russia over Ukraine will not affect cooperation with Iran within the framework of the JCPOA.
We received written guarantees. They are included in the text of the agreement itself on the resumption of the JCPOA on the Iranian nuclear program. These texts provide reliable protection for all the projects and areas of activity envisaged by the JCPOA, including the direct involvement of our companies, specialists, including their cooperation on such a flagship project of our cooperation as the Bushehr nuclear power plant, in the context of all existing plans in this regard.
Lavrov also rejected claims that Russia has created an obstacle to negotiations in the Austrian capital, backing the quick revival of the 2015 agreement.
There have been no exorbitant demands from our side, and there are none. All our rights within the framework of cooperation with Iran on the projects that the JCPOA provides for are reliably protected. I have heard how the Americans are trying to accuse us every day that we are slowing down this agreement. That's a lie. The agreement has not yet been finally approved in some capitals, and the Russian capital, Moscow, is not among them.
Amir Abdollahian and Lavrov also discussed other issues, including the Ukrainian conflict and regional issues such as developments in Afghanistan, Syria and Yemen.
The foreign ministers, along with political and diplomatic issues, discussed economic affairs in order to neutralize the negative impacts and consequences of the U.S. and Western anti-Moscow sanctions through closer cooperation and rapprochement. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The figures were stark, even for those used to dealing with sobering news coming out of Riyadh. The news that the kingdom had executed 81 individuals with little fanfare. The news that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson would then be travelling to Saudi Arabia to meet with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman could not have come at